Welcome to the Our Baldizon podcast. I am Roberto Baldizon for ourbaldizon.com blog and the podcast, of course, which you are listening to at this time. Thank you so much for investing of your time, and hopefully you will walk away with a few lessons for something to consider regarding the job that you're doing in your school. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking to a great colleague out in Vienna, Austria. He is Sean Thomas, Sean T is his handle. I'm pretty sure many of you are familiar with it. He gives us some great insight about integrating technology into the curriculum, and moreover, how to manage the whole job of all these relationships and what it implies to have a team, to work with an IT team, and as well as impact on faculty and what they're doing with the students, and who to partner with, how to partner with them, and some great insight into his thinking. So I really want to thank and give a great shout out to Sean for putting himself out there and for creating this time. We've tried several times. We've had several conversations in the past where we've exchanged great information, because he is kind of still trying to angle himself into the type of position where he is maximizing his impact on the people around him, and not only because of what he is bringing to the table, what he is doing, but moreover, how he is doing it. Sean is an incredible soul and a great professional. I invite you to listen up and pay really close attention to his approach. Remember, this podcast is not being sponsored, and I hope that you do take the time to go back to iTunes and give me some stars, provide me with some comments. And also, if you yourself or you know of somebody who would benefit or would like to be a guest on these conversations that I'm holding, by all means, please point them my way, rbaldizon@gmail.com. Or go to the blog and just hit the contact tab, and you're able to get to me, and I would love to touch base with you or more colleagues around the globe. Enjoy the interview. Okay, so with me today, I have Sean Thomas Maroney, Sean TM, better known. Online, I want to thank you, Sean. You're working in the Vienna International School in Vienna, Austria. Go ahead and give it a little background of what you're doing there. What's your official title, and how long you've been there?
Super. Well, first of all, thanks so much for having me today, Roberto. Much appreciated. Yes, I'm currently at the Vienna International School in Vienna, Austria. As implied, it is an international school. I am working as the leader for digital learning. That is my title. And essentially, it's one of those permutations of many kinds that basically means we're dealing with the way ICT or digital technologies is leveraged to optimize learning and teaching.
Okay.
So it's the educational side of working with technologies to support learning and teaching.
Okay, so how old and how big is the school, and what grade levels are you dealing with there?
The school is about 38 years old. Okay. It's actually going through an anniversary this year, celebrating its 30th year at its particular location, which is right at the edge of Vienna. Okay. It was started as part of an effort to grow the United Nations organization presence here in Vienna years ago, with the understanding that any diplomats or folks attached to those UN organizations would bring along their families, and there'd be a need to have them educated. So it truly is an international school, and it's very closely aligned with the United Nations organizations because that's the need that it fulfills primarily. 65% of the families and the students that are involved with the school are UN-based.
Wow. That's quite a cross-sample of the cultures of the world.
It is. I'm told we've got 123 different nationalities.
Wow.
At the school. Please don't ask me to name them all. But I know there is, as you've said, a wide spread or wide range of representation there.
How many students, what grade levels and how many students are you dealing with?
The school starts with an early years program, which is pre-K. I believe it's age 3, as early as age 3. And we go right up to grade 12 to graduate. School is approximately in the secondary level, I think, what do we have? About 1,200 students,
wow,
less perhaps than that. And then the rest is in the primary school and early years section. They call it the early years center.
Okay.
So a fairly large school. We're the third or fourth largest school in Northern Europe.
That is a lot of bodies on campus. And now you're in charge, and you're in a particular position where, you know, this has not been happening very long, at least not in the grander scheme of things, that you're kind of that go-between the educational, the academic side of a school, and the IT platform, you know, servers, the core IT stuff. You're right smack in the middle. How long you've been at it there at Vienna International?
2 years so far, and wow, feels like it's been longer.
When you say it, now
some days it feels shorter, but a lot of times.
Indeed. Now, was there someone there already occupying that post before you arrived, or is this a relatively new post at that school?
It's a relatively new post. In fact, it's brand new. There was never a position like this one in particular in the past. And you sort of alluded to it when you started to explain, or started to inquire, rather, that this sort of thing is kind of new.
Yeah.
When you say this sort of thing is kind of new, you're right. It reflects a trend that, you know, is taking place in a number of schools where it's kind of understood that there needs to be somewhat of a severance between the folks that deal with infrastructural aspects of ICT and the folks that deal or focus primarily on the pedagogical or methodological aspect of curriculum and learning and teaching. That's not to say that the role couldn't be combined. There are lots of folks who do both. In fact, I think that's what you do. Am I right?
Yes. Yes. Unfortunately, up to this point, I've had to.
Yeah.
Now I'm wondering, where were you before arriving in Vienna?
Prior to Vienna, I was in Singapore. I was actually 10 years in Asia,
okay.
So Singapore and China, and spent a little bit of time in Korea as well, but mostly in Asia. And yeah, it's a very different world, actually.
Indeed. And with a young family, of course. You know, you're not alone in this.
No, not. I'm fortunate to have my wife and my daughter with me. And my daughter is actually born here, so she's an honorary Austrian and a true multicultural citizen.
Indeed.
Asian American, Irish, made in Singapore.
Jeez.
Delivered in Austin.
You're going to need a book bag for those many passports.
That's right.
Now, you walked into this position that puts you in a sort of a very different position in a school of this size. Now, I'm wondering, how did you walk into this place knowing what it means? Because, one, people have to be educated, not... You know, I would venture that not everyone is clear on what it is you're supposed to be doing in that school, given the prior structure. So how has it gone thus far? What has it been like?
Well, I face a number of challenges in particular in that this is a school, like a number of schools, that does a lot of things really, really well.
Yes.
It's a school that has developed and, or earned, I should say, a reputation through the years since really the beginning of kind of the prominence of the IB program. The school's known for its strengths in the International Baccalaureate Organization program. It's a three-program IB school, World IB School, possibly maybe a four-program IB World School at some point. And one of its great claims to fame is that the PYP was developed partially at this school. Wow. So the reason I'm telling you all this, to give you this background, is that there's a very, very definitive focus on excellence in terms of curriculum and delivery. So teaching methodology and the processes that people who are familiar with the IB will know, all the different learner profile aspects that will ideally follow students up from early years through the MYP program and then finally to the DP or diploma program. So there's a lot of demands that come from having all these programs in place, and a lot of demands are placed on students. So this means that people are tremendously busy at this school. And beyond that, there's a tremendous amount of enrichment as well, and that looks a variety of different ways. Another acknowledged strength of the Vienna International School, and I think this is partially reflective of where we are, is its arts program. Incredible music, incredible visual and performing arts department and teachers here, incredible things happening in that whole domain. But people are super busy. It's a very, very busy place. And innovation and kind of bringing new things online sometimes can be a bit of a challenge because it's a schedule that's already chock full.
Yes.
So then you get into this idea when you talk about being a change agent or kind of working on change management, which is absolutely integral to the part or I have and the role I play of trying to determine how you can develop capacity. In other words, how you can make room for doing things in maybe different, more expansive ways, or in some cases doing new things altogether, which technology, of course, allows us to do. So these are things these are some realities that I face in the role that I'm in and in my sort of day-to-day comings and goings at the school. It's necessary that you understand at least in abstract what I'm talking about in terms of the environment. And helping people to better understand what I do helps them, really entails helping them better understand what it is I'm focused on, which is what I just explained. Doing the great things that we're doing in perhaps some new and more expansive or different sorts of ways, or maybe doing new things altogether that they haven't tried yet. And the rationale that I find wins the day, that absolutely, you know, kind of begins and ends all these conversations, is because it's really good for the students. Look at the students that you're teaching. Look at the world that they're entering and that they're inheriting. It's a world where they need to be technologically adept. It's a world where they need to be not just tech savvy, but fluent, technologically fluent. So it's important that we provide opportunities for them to be able to come to know and work with these technologies within their whole academic regimen.
You know, sounds familiar, and I'm glad you brought it up. I had a conversation with the outgoing tech director, John Michten, from the International School of Prague.
Oh, I know John.
A few podcasts ago, and he mentioned the same thing. If you come to the table, and at the end of the conversation, it is clear to whoever is in the room that the reason you're doing whatever it is you're proposing to do is to make learning better, it leaves very little room for argument. And I've taken that also quite literally in my own approach to proposing ideas or just, you know, different approaches to teaching and learning in the classroom with technology being embedded by proposing that, you know, we think about education. What is it that we're going for at the end of the day? And once we part from that and we all agree that that's the benefit that we're all going for, then the conversation takes a different tone and it takes a different direction. So I'm wondering, who are your partners in the school that you kind of align yourself with to continue to you know, pick away at change, which is not easy, particularly in a school. Change is not easy, and here you are with a bag full of change. So who are your partners here, and how do you manage and kind of work that environment?
That's an important question. I don't want to sound coy or anything. I'd say my absolute first partners, though, because I've thought about this quite a bit, are the students.
Okay,
those are my first partners. We're partners in learning. And this is something I try to explain to parents a lot. I do my best to sort of involve parents as much as I can in these conversations and in the further development and evolution of the role of so-called digital learning at the school. My first partners absolutely are the kids. And then, the so-called and very familiar, time-tried early adopters, which are people that are doing exciting and interesting things that have students powered on and are kind of the willing, you're working with the willing. I also work really with anybody who's interested in trying out new things, anyone who's interested in innovation. It's easy to identify partners when you find people that, are very active in terms of inquiring about how they might do in new work with new things, new technologies. But really, to win the day, it's important to find folks that maybe are less prominent on the radar screen. And those are the folks that you've got to kind of bring into the fold, that you've got to win the hearts and minds of, to use a sort of well-worn cliche, and help them understand that this is something that's really not just about them improving their teaching practice, because a lot of the time that's how it feels to them. They're kind of being told that they've got to do more as a classroom teacher or a subject teacher, or they need to do different, things in a different sort of way. And a lot of the time that's not interpreted in the most positive of lights. It seems somehow as there's something, in deficit or lacking in the way that they're doing their teaching practice. But that's actually not what the message is. The message is, once again, allowing new and powerful teaching and learning opportunities to be available to their students and to themselves. So having them become partners is kind of really that's kind of the grail. That's what I'm looking at. The folks that maybe feel like their comfort zone isn't kind of broad enough right now, or they've got so much on their plate, they're so busy that this is just something that they just really can't afford at this point in their career or in what they're doing to accommodate this idea of doing, digital learning. So if I was to speak in a pragmatic sense for folks out there, they're kind of like, okay, well, what does all that mean? One of the things I did when I first got to the school was start a digital learning study and advisory group. And that digital learning study and advisory group consists of stakeholders from every aspect of the community: students, teachers, parents, and administrative staff. So folks that are maybe not teaching necessarily, but they're doing some other essential task at the school. So we've got representation that is as, complete as possible of the community. And together we work on doing different things that I believe will help move the agenda of digital learning forward. Digital learning was a strategic goal that was set by the stakeholders at the school.
It's 8:00.
4 years ago.
Okay.
So this exists as something that's not, a foggy or mysterious, objective. It's a very clear directive, and it's something that we're trying to actualize, and we're hoping that it will be actualized within the next couple of years. So the group helps to inform policy, procedure, protocol that helps realize that objective, that goal of becoming more digitally and ICT integrated.
Okay, and now
I'll just finish with this. The most tangible outcome that the group has been able to generate since its inception was the development of a vision for digital learning and ICT at the Vienna International School, which was the first in its history, and that makes very clear what it is that we hope the optimization of learning and teaching with ICT and digital tools looks like.
Okay. So you have, on the other side of that stakeholder group, you have the IT department. I'm wondering, how many people are you working with in your own group, or are you a lone ranger? And how many people are there in the IT department, and how does that interface happen?
Okay, yeah, that's also a very important question. As you can imagine, I do work fairly closely with the technical, it's called the technical support team here.
Okay.
You know, my hat goes off to these guys and every day in more ways than one. There's really only three of them, and they take care of an awfully big remit. It's a big, big job, and there's three people that attend to it.
That sounds like a handful.
It is. It's a real challenge. I mean, this is a big school. There's 1,800 students. There's 261 staff, and then there's a number of part-timers as well. All of them have ICT needs. It's a technologically rich environment in the sense that there's a heck of a lot of hardware out there on the floor, and all that requires maintenance, upkeep, attending to, and these guys do it with essentially what is a skeleton crew. So tremendous respect and dependence I have with these folks. In terms of collaboration, I try to communicate as clearly as possible with all the members of the team. It's not like we have regular structured meetings. I usually end up meeting with the TST manager or team leader. I'll meet with him very regularly and kind of talk about where we are and what kinds of things I kind of hope. Before I put together these big ambitious schemes, I make sure that I have conversations with him about this. And, you know, how doable is this? Is this something that's really viable, or is it pragmatic? Or what would it take? What would it require to, do this particular sort of thing at the school technologically? What would, do we have the capacity for it, or how can we develop it? So we try to not work in isolation at all, but working as closely as possible in tandem with these folks, and when necessary, be one of them.
Okay.
And so that I co-opt their insights and what I think are, enthusiasm and good ideas as one of us. I'm trying to really build a culture of community. So several of these TST folks are on that digital study and advisory group. When I say several, I mean the majority of the team are involved with it. So that alone will show you that, there's some good input, and there's some good exchange going on in terms of them being, a part of this whole process, as opposed to somebody who has to come in and support it after the fact.
Yeah. Okay. That's very important. Now, one of the things that we were talking about before starting to record this conversation was the introduction of this, the many initiatives that you're trying to get the governing body there to kind of take on, understand, and then move on. Can you talk a little bit about what you're proposing and what is actually slated for you to get started on in the coming year?
There's a number of elements. There's a three-year strategic plan that I wrote this year with the input of the Digital Study Advisory Group and other key players. It's kind of funny. I mean, I laughingly refer to it as, the new Luther thesis, because there's 99 elements in the three-year plan. Yeah, there's a lot. Jeez. There's a lot of dependencies and kind of like this has to happen, if, what, then,
Okay. So it's more like a code for a program.
Yeah, it's big. I mean, my direct manager and boss, my line manager, the director of the school, he's a real empiricist. I showed him the vision statement. He's like, that's really great. How are you going to make it happen? And I said, well, this and that. And he said, no, I need to see a plan. And I mean a detailed plan.
Wow.
So like I overcame all my sort of Michael Fullan-esque complexity impulses. Michael Fullan always says, the more streamlined your plan can be, the better it will flow and the better it will go. And I kind of had to get down to the nitty-gritty and do a tremendous amount of really detailed planning and work. So it's been done. I also worked with what were initially 10, and then it became 12 large strategic goals that I presented to the Board of Governors. I won't go through them all now, but the ones that we're looking at in the short run are to develop a set of school-based ICT or digital learning standards this is analogous to sort of the idea of sort of the ISTE standards, right?
Or the NETs. Yeah.
The NETs, right, or the BECTA standards in the past, some of the other ones that might exist out there, you know, in the matrices. And that, for, you know, I think practical purposes, provides a framework upon which you can then auger and sort of measure, you know, where you are. And that's something that this school in particular, I think, needs, because this is a school, as I said, that's been focused on a lot of other things, a lot of very important and really great things in terms of learning and teaching, but so much so that the whole ICT digital realm can be a bit overwhelming. It seems like this ever-expanding universe that a lot of folks are kind of intimidated by, because, you know, again, it's difficult to know what you know or what you don't know when it's moving that fast and it's changing that quickly.
Indeed.
So I believe these standards will help folks kind of better measure, you know, what it is that the expectations are around our students' proficiencies and understandings, and what the expectations should be in terms of when they receive the students and, you know, where they are. And I keep trying to help them understand that, you know, this whole process is about being, again, partners in learning. No, nobody expects you to, as part of your teaching craft, to be some sort of, like, you know, computer expert. And sometimes that's how it's understood, is that people have to be technologists to be able to do this stuff. And, you know, it's really important that we find ways to make it as accessible as possible. I actually believe that the standards can help that happen, because it gives you tangible and very clear ideas about what those skills and understandings might look. So the standards are a big piece of it. In a more traditional sense, or maybe more familiar sense with folks in the kind of hardcore ICT world, a one-to-one program was something that was bandied about, debated, and argued for actually a number of years at the school. All those conversations were inconclusive, but I, after, you know, about a year-long study and audit, decided that maybe a better way to go was to work on putting a bring-your-own-device program in place. And part of the reason was, is because I came to learn over that year that a very large number of students in the upper grades were already bringing their own devices to school and working with them. So we had sort of momentum already. We had students that were doing this and, you know, and kind of experiencing their school day and their school year with the aid and assistance of their own devices, their own personalized digital tools that they were bringing. So it seemed to me, in a sense, to kind of be the best way to go. Concurrently, we're looking at putting a tablet program, and there was a proposal to put a tablet program in place in the primary school.
Okay.
We did this in what I felt was a very kind of, you know, we did with integrity. We did an action research program and did a lot of data collection around the concept. We used both Android and iOS devices, iPads and Samsung tablets, and we distributed them to a couple different classes, and then tried over a term to gather as much data as we could about how it shifted learning and teaching. And though I'd say there's still probably a lot of open questions, maybe more so than answers, what we did learn was that it did create access in a broader sense, greater access. And because of that, we thought more opportunities to learn and teach in different ways that without the devices being available to them maybe wouldn't exist.
And, you know, and another thing I've found over the years is with the same approach is that differentiation factor and how much faster you can address that in the classroom, especially at an international school with so much transient, you know, student body coming in and out throughout every year, is the types of capacities that you're getting through a classroom and in any given year, and how you can aid those students who are struggling or those students who are actually at the other side of that, and you don't want them to get bored.
Engagement's definitely, you know, one of the pros of these programs.
Absolutely.
Of course, folks on the other side, the Diabolos Abacate argument, the devil's advocate argument is well, engagement or distraction, right?
Yes.
Education or edutainment. And I think those are all very valid, important points to consider. The handwriting issue is one that comes up. Screen time is one that comes up. This is in particular in the context of younger students. So say, if you will, maybe ages 14 down, although certainly there's some issues in older levels as well, or grades. But these are things that, you know, were concerns that have been voiced and will continue to be. And I think that one thing that we really have to work on, I mentioned the standards piece, but if I had to identify within that how that might look more clearly or in a more definitive sense, it would be digital citizenship. And that's going to be a need that, regardless of the way ICT in schools evolves, and I hope it evolves as being just a part of the process. I hope that, you know, jobs like mine will become obsolete because it will no longer be necessary. It'll just be part of what we do in school. But I think that's probably a ways off for a lot of schools.
I believe it is.
Point being that the digital citizenship piece is never going to go away. You know, having to teach people how to use computers or how to do maybe smart research or how to work with specific new applications or tools, those sorts of things I think are going to lessen in terms of the needs that exist in our modern school setting. But the digital citizenship piece, it will not. You know, how to manage your own data, how to be able to shape your presence in the online world, that false veil or sense of anonymity, how to interact in the virtual world, how to understand the differences between that and the actual world. You hear a lot of complaints these days from folks that maybe are in a different generation, that kids don't know how to really socialize or interact these days. They spend too much time on machines. I'm not sure about the validity of that concern, but I do know that there are a lot more distractions these days, and kids always needed guidance in terms of how to interact with each other and one another in the right place and context. And because we've got more venues now, some of those virtual or digital, that need is ongoing and persists.
Absolutely. Now, who else is helping you as far as do you have a team that works directly with you in this effort, or are you addressing the pre-K to 12 realm there?
I'm fortunate to have the assistance in the primary level of a very skilled ICT learning facilitator. Okay. And there's another part-time person that works as a information literacy and a librarian, basically a teacher librarian, but with okay. a sort of emphasis on that digital realm. But the heavy lifting in terms of the day-to-day activity in the class is done, again, by a very, very busy and very capable digital learning facilitator who works early years up through grade 5. Grade 6 starts the secondary process at this school.
Okay. And so as you see this BYOD and potential tablet program. First, what are you going with on the lower grades as far as a device and operating system?
The outcome of the action research program basically led us to believe that the best tools to put in place for this program in our particular learning environment, VIS, would be iPads.
Okay. And in the BYOD, is there any... Are you shaping any sort of hard requirements, or are you just leaving it open to the family and student to decide? How is that going to roll out?
We're still kind of nailing the details down on that.
Okay.
There is a chance that we might recommend one platform. There is a chance that we might do that. But I can't say much more about that right now because okay. we're still sort of getting clear on the best way to shape those recommendations. So we need to do a little bit more due diligence around that.
Okay.
Some of the arguments that I might make for going one platform would be the presence of that particular platform already in the learning environment, and also a lot of precedent in history in terms of, you know, different companies or corporations supporting these types of programs, especially in the area of staff development.
And, you know, the other impacting thing, and I spoke to Shahid in Bangladesh. He's at the International School of Dhaka. And what they've done is they narrowed the scope to one or two different variations of one platform. And the reason that they're doing this is because kind of like what you have there at Vienna International is you have a very small crew of people supporting these devices. So to have a wide realm or you know, to have so many flavors in the mix makes it that much more difficult to support those devices. Because at the end of the day, if something goes wrong with it, the teacher and or the student come to the IT department and say, hey, you know, this is not doing whatever it needs to be doing. And they have to go ahead and kind of aid the student, even though it's not a school-purchased device, the IT department still has to help that student get to the information and the work that they need to do. And then, of course, what you're talking about as well is it impacts on professional development, because the first point of contact when a student has a problem is usually the teacher. And you know, the better versed they are in identifying at least where the issue is coming from and not necessarily fixing it, but if you have so many more different, you know, manufacturers and operating systems and whatnot, it kind of slows the entire process of resolution. You know, it slows it up, and therefore it impacts on that student in that classroom.
Yeah, these are really... I think important and valid points you're making, and that's something that has to be considered. You know, one has to be a little bit careful, I guess, semantically. A colleague of ours, I have to quote him, Anthony DiProto, he self-authored the BYOD handbook.
Okay.
That's actually going through a revision right now. He's going to expanded to include iPad implementation. But it's a very, very well written, and I recommend it to anybody who's in the midst of considering a BYOD program. Handbook, light, very, very easy to read, not filled with technical jargon or acronyms, and underpinned by a great sense of humor as well. But he makes the point that, you know, if you want to walk your talk about a BYOD program, then you know, you really do have to think of the freedom of choice as being an essential tenet of it. I think he even quotes somebody saying, well, why don't you just go with Apple or something? He said, well, because then we'd be doing a bring your own Apple program, not a be your own device program.
Absolutely. And, you
know, yeah, there's something to that. I mean, I have to sort of I kind of have to concede that if you proscribe the recommendations in terms of what you're asking your student population and your families to bring to the school, then, you know, it may be their own device, but, you know, you're kind of leading the witness in a sense. Not that that's necessarily a bad thing. I mean, you have to think about all the other causes and conditions that are very compelling in terms of making this whole program work. You pointed out some technical challenges that exist. If you've got a skeleton crew that's able to support this type of implementation, both in the presence of capable tech staff, but also folks that are doing digital integration and supporting it in the classrooms, then you may need to consider a more narrow set of choices or recommendations, because otherwise you just spend a lot of time trying to make this stuff work. You and know, to quote John Micton, uh-huh. The stuff's got to work.
Absolutely. That's one of the things when I'm looking at large purchases or anything that's going to impact the classroom, I'm always looking for consumer type technology. Anything that the end user can pick up, like a remote control for a flat screen that is a consumer facing product, makes my life easier because they already know how to utilize it. I don't have to spend that extra time teaching them and whatever. So it kind of eliminates some of those issues, even when there are issues. The other side of that, and you know, at the school where I am, a much smaller school, and it being only a high school, most of the students already bring a device into the school. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we're still not down the path of a BYOD officially yet, but you know, it's like 40 and 60% of the students already bring a device onto school. I think once we get there, it'll be a point where we are allowing that full range of freedom to the student, as well as the school itself, because we have a large contingent of moderated tuition families who would not be able to afford a device, that the school can then provide a Google Chrome device or a you know, a hand-me-down of the loaners that we use of the Apple MacBook Pros or MacBook Airs. And I think that's one of the ways that we will try to aid those families. But you're right. On the other end of that, if you kind of narrow the choice for them, it the labeling should be different. And it certainly, it takes a different tone. And at the same time, it some things may work for some schools. And again, I come back to one is budgeting time. You know, what kind of professional development can you do behind that? Because usually in a BYOD setup, the faculty member is usually the first point of contact for technical support. And yep. then how much tech support do you actually have behind that that you can afford to open the faucet in that way? So it's a lot of moving parts there.
That's absolutely it. That's so true. If you ever get a chance, or maybe you have already, have you interviewed Alan Price before?
No, I have not.
Tech director at the Atlantic International School, Atlanta International School. Another friend and colleague, and he and I, we talk pretty frequently. And if it's better, faster, cheaper, adopt it.
Absolutely.
But the better part and the faster part has to mean that it's streamlined and low maintenance. So there's not some teacher scratching their head and losing value class time trying to figure out why this thing won't connect or
yes.
why, et cetera, et cetera. So now I've quoted John Mitkin, I've quoted Anthony DiPrato, who you also interviewed. You get a chance
Absolutely.
To have a face as well. But yeah, we talk about that a lot. And one of the things that's made it easier doing these sorts of programs and made the sort of platform question a little less of an issue, actually I'd say a lot less of an issue, is the advent of the cloud. And one of the other major recommendations I gave to the Board of Governors that I was one of the first ones for them to really hear and adopt was, if you want to talk about projecting large, long-term and broader investments in terms of capital, invest in bandwidth. This is where you really need to go, because more and more things are happening in the cloud.
You know, I've been preaching that for the last 12 years, is if you have any money in IT in the school, let it go to bandwidth.
Precisely. So a lot of, as opposed to when we got started in this whole business in, you know, the 90s, or in some cases for some people, late 80s, it was all about what resources you could bring to bear upon the learning environment and to support or get into the hands of users. These days, users, when I say users, I mean in the sense of computer users, we're going to some place to get the resources. The resources are there, and we're going to them. They're available, and they're freely available, as long as we provide the access. And all too often, that means not just the digital device, it means connectivity. It means bandwidth. So this was another one of the major initiatives that I've put in place, and I'm happy to say they've listened to and they've adopted. We went from a 25 to 30 megabyte stream to a 100 megabyte stream right now, and we're going to be going to 200. This is next year, and we're going to continue to expand as our needs in terms of our local area network expand as well.
That's a very smart move. Very smart move.
We've got, like so many schools, a Google Apps for Education instance. It's combined with a somewhat complex Moodle we've put together. So we've got a Moogle, an LMS, learning management system that I hope to evolve into a full-blown virtual learning environment. And we're getting there. These things, of course, have to evolve. But these are all aspects of that investiture in bandwidth and creating access and capacity, as opposed to just trying to stock, recycle, and maintain hardware on the floor.
Absolutely. Very smart approach there. You know, I think in my view, and a lot of schools are already there, but as we continue to head down this road where we are becoming cloud heavy, you see a less dependency on any one given platform or device, but rather the dependency on connectivity. You have to have access, and you have to have fast and reliable access anywhere you are, because you know even the data that you hold, that you work with every single day, you can go from device to device to device. As long as you have connectivity, you'll have access to that data. So it doesn't need to be sitting anywhere on your hard disks or what have you. So you're no longer tethered.
Right.
But it takes a village, right? I think there's a lot of moving parts in moving that strategy forward, and so many components that need to be in place even before you begin to have that conversation of, hey, the school needs to have a whatever next step towards this 21st century learning environment that we thought of, you know, a very long time ago, that it immerses the learning, teaching and learning in the classroom, and the walls are no longer there. So you have access to everything readily, so it's no longer a question of memory, but rather what do you do with it? What do you do with this information?
Yeah, you're so right. I mean, ironically, I reflected more and more this year is one where I did a lot of reflection about, you know, where we started with all this and where we might be going. And I've got another good friend and colleague in Dr. John Turner, who's a tech director at the Canadian International School of Hong Kong. And he and I have a lot of discourse and interchange, and we thought, you know, gee, wow, well, where's it all going? You know, what's next? You know, and we reflect a lot about that, and, you know, what's going to happen. And one of the things I can try to put it in simple terms, what is actually a very complicated subject, is when we got started in this business, it was about trying to get people, you know, connected and turned on, and, you know, a different sort of access to learning about these new tools and opportunities. There's a lot of huge amount of excitement and enthusiasm about, you know, getting people interconnected with one another and allowing them to even understand that there's a whole new world to be had out there in terms of the virtual realm. And then the issues around how this could be, you know, sort of an equalizer. It could level the playing field in terms of the divides that exist socioeconomically, and it can bring people from disparate parts of the planet together and to do some incredibly powerful things, as well as provide a platform for folks that in the past maybe didn't have it for personal expression and communication.
Absolutely.
So, it was like, you know, it really is like this sense of like a revolution, the whole digital revolution and this whole renaissance of learning, because suddenly there is this windfall of information that, you know, unlike any time ever before, was suddenly available to people because the internet's growth was so exponential. So now I'm talking, the year I'm talking about was like 1995, 1996, 1997, 1998. Now it's changed. Now the kids that we're working with, as we all know, well, they've never known a world without any of this stuff. This is the world to them. You know, you talk about technology or computers, and they kind of look at you and maybe a bit askance at times, because to them it's just another dimension. It's not like some separate sort of thing. It's just, you know, I mean, digital tools to most of these kids, at least in the more part, you know, well-developed parts of the world, they're just appliances. You know, asking them to go to a computer class would be like asking us in the 90s to go to a toaster or a TV class. Well, what would you need to do that for?
Absolutely.
They're just so commonplace. And you know what I'm saying? You know, you put an iPhone or a tablet in the hands of a small child and watch them zoom around on it, and you're just like, whoa, that's scary. But my point is that now, more and more, I think we're charged with a duty to kind of help them understand, not so much necessarily how all this stuff works, unless they want to, you know, become programmers and those sorts of things, but how to work with it, how to best work with it.
Absolutely.
So the shift there is that, you know, it's less of a concern, again, at least in the developed world. I'm not talking about some parts of the developing world that are still in need of this. I'm talking about much of the developed world. It's less about, you know, providing and ensuring that kids know about this stuff and that they're able to have opportunities to get at it, although in schools access still can be an issue. It's helping them better learn about when they have access to it and they're working with it and it's all around them, how to best work with it safely, with, you know, discernment, ergonomically, correctly, and in a manner that I think I'm kind of struggling for words here, but in a manner that is really the healthiest. And I mean that on all levels. So more and more my focus this year has been thinking about, you know, mindful and balanced use. And I've got a sort of developing thesis about how that might look. In other words, how to have these tools remain as something that enhances our lives, that enriches our opportunities for lifelong learning, as opposed to becoming things that distract, detract, and in some ways maybe take away from
absolutely
our experience.
And that's the last thing we want, is to actually go backwards while we're trying to go forward here, adding tools and whatnot. Which is why, you know, like, your position is so important in these schools, because, you know, one of the things that we have is we have these, you know, digital natives. It's the commonly used term here of students who swimming this digital realm, and you have these adults who are still trying to get a grasp of it, and we're supposed to be teaching them. So it's an interesting time right now. And I think the more that we have folks like you who are bridging those two worlds and who are able to converse and make that conversation happen between the faculty and the students much easier, the better we are entirely, simply because it begins to move forward as an orchestra should move forward. Everybody knows their part, and it sounds good. I think it's important to continue to have these kinds of conversations throughout the many schools that there are, especially independent schools, international schools, because usually, you know, the communities in these schools happen to be floating about a lot more freely, and therefore can cross-pollinate each other with these ideas and what they're being exposed to in any given school. You know, Sean, I know I've taken more than the time that you had available, and I want to thank you for that. But before I let you go, I got one last question for you, and that is, being that you're in Vienna, in an international school, with your international family, what is your summer looking like?
Oh, okay. Well, I think it's looking at like a celebration thinking locally and living globally.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Actually, let me put it the other way. Living locally and thinking globally. Excuse me. I mixed that up. But no, it's been a really great experience. We are absolutely a product of our times. I'm saying myself and my immediate family. We are tremendously fortunate to have lived in two incredible centuries where just so much has happened in the last two or three decades, perhaps more in terms of really, ontologically transforming movements to our human species than maybe centuries before. And it's not just truly an exciting time. I think it's an inspiring and vital time to be around and to be alive. I'm really fortunate to have had the time to talk about this tonight, and hopefully we can do it again at some point. I leave you with this. I again think that it's really important that we now understand that since we've got all this stuff, we have opened a bit of a Pandora's box in terms of how interconnected we are. And there is a challenge, again, in that sort of maintaining that balance. There's a lot that exists in this world that already conspires against us getting to know who we truly are. There's a lot of distractions, and there's a lot of things that pull away our attention. And it's important that we remember to take time and understand that, you know, connecting to the real world is something that we have to do before we can, you know, truly understand what it means to be in a virtual world as well. And that's something I hope that that all of us can continue to do. So this summer we'll be doing a lot more of that.
Fantastic, fantastic. Sounds like a joy to be disconnected. You know, I know that even the little nicks of time here that I'm able to carve away this summer are for that, to shut the laptop, to disconnect, and to kind of breathe in the air and enjoy where I am. And that's also equally important, especially as you get ready to return and hit a full year precisely with what you're doing at your school, which is launching these major initiatives concurrently. And that's going to require a whole lot of effort and a lot of energy.
Indeed.
Thank you so much, Sean. It has been a pleasure.
Okay. Well, thanks. Thank you so much, Roberto. And all the best to you.
I hope you did get something useful out of this conversation with Sean. As you know, you can contact him on Twitter. You can contact me on Twitter, on my blog, via email, rbaldezon@gmail.com. And again, the invitation, go back to iTunes, give me some stars, provide some feedback, get the commentaries going, and start a conversation regarding this so very important topic of sitting in the middle of what faculty are doing academically in a school and what IT is doing in the IT realm of a school and how that integration component is so very important. Do hit me up, rbaldezon@gmail.com, and the blog post is rbaldezon.com. Enjoy your week.